Thanks for joining us. I'm Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back next week. The NSA's bulk data collection could come to an end with its fate hanging on a Senate vote today. An unprecedented airbag recall could take years to complete. Big banks plead guilty to massive currency manipulation, and what to expect from Hillary Clinton's emails. Joining me for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Neil King Jr. of the Wall Street Journal, Christina Bellantoni of Roll Call, and Jeff Mason of Reuters. You can watch a live video stream of our conversation on our website, drshow.org. We'll be taking your questions and your comments throughout the hour. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. Welcome, everyone.
Good morning.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday is right. So, Jeff, I want to start with you. The Senate is supposed to decide today whether to preserve the Patriot Act, the law that passed after the September 11th attacks that grants the government vast surveillance powers. So what's the latest?
So a lot of controversy over this particular issue. As people will remember, Edward Snowden was involved in revealing some of the details about what kind of data was or has been pulled together by the NSA, bulk phone data that is very controversial about in terms of privacy, in terms of what people, information is being saved by the government. So debate on both sides among Republicans and Democrats, and particularly within the Republican Party, about how much of that should be preserved. And that's being debated today in the Senate.
So is Majority Leader Mitch McConnell going to keep his colleagues working through the weekend on this?
It certainly looks like that's possible. We were just talking before the show started about the police needing to have do a little bit more overtime because of both the Congress staying in session, but also Memorial Day weekend activities. So, yes, it looks like it may be
a
long
few hours. He's going to keep them working hard. Christina?
I will say that nothing motivates senators to get out of the way like the smell of jet fumes and a long weekend. The House has already gone home, and senators are frustrated. Senator Rand Paul basically slowed down debate in what he likes to call a filibuster on this very issue, and it illustrated this divide that Jeff's talking about that's not, it's not really partisan. It's this strange ideological divide, and you've got all of the Senate presidential contenders on different sides of this issue. Marco Rubio is siding with Mitch McConnell, basically saying we need to have the strongest protections as possible to prevent any terrorist attacks, anything like that. And then you've got Ted Cruz, who's standing with what the House passed overwhelmingly. There were only 88 no votes in the House to basically expand the USA Freedom Act, but not allow for the bulk collection of data. And then you've got Rand Paul, you know, not only trying to lead this effort and get attention, but he's siding with some of the most liberal Democrats on this issue, saying we've gone too far. Privacy is a big concern here. And so it's a strange debate to watch when the nation has seen the Edward Snowden issue evolve and people really feeling as if their privacy is being violated.
Mm-hmm. Well, for once to have Ted Cruz siding with the president is interesting because the president has been urging the Senate to approve the House version of the bill. Is that possible?
It's possible. I don't know that we know how this is all going to shake out. They're trying to cut a lot of deals. You know, just this morning, our CQ floor watchers are sending all of these different updates. Mitch McConnell is saying, look, you know, we'll try to allow as many amendments. We're going to maybe consider how long these records are stored. Is it 6 months? Is it 2 years? Do the private companies, you know, the AT&Ts and the Verizons, do they have the power here, or do we allow the government to have the power? And the big question is whether they allow it to expire on June 1st.
So, Neil, what happens if the Senate doesn't act? The Justice Department has said that the NSA will stop sweeping up our telephone metadata?
I think it actually goes beyond that. The administration has been arguing that if they actually are forced to shut it down, they have to shut it down in ways that things go away, and that the all this data that they've accumulated would be wiped away. There was actually a briefing they gave this during the week, and it says, so the bottom line is that, this is one of the top administration officials, is that anything other than the passage of the USA Freedom Act, which is the House bill, creates real uncertainty both operationally and legally for our operators and for our national security professionals. So they're arguing that it would be disastrous, really, and without any real certainty about when it would be revived. We've seen so many weird moments this year so far of alliances between the White House and various portions of the Republican Party. And I don't know. I don't know if I can remember another time when the White House is saying that bill that the House just passed. We love that bill.
Yeah, that's the one.
And Senate, weird, goofy people in the Senate, you should pass that bill. And that's actually what's happened here. And if they don't pass, if the Senate doesn't go along with exactly what the House did, then they would be in the position of John Boehner having to say, hey, all 435 House people, you're going to have to come back to town. We're going to have to vote now to keep this alive, which would be complicated, to say the least. I don't know whether it's likely to happen, but we'll talk about trade in a minute. But amazing thing is that Mitch McConnell really, really wants to move forward on this huge trade bill today. And at the same time, they're having a huge debate over the whole NSA privacy issue, which is equally as complicated and equally fraught in many ways.
And the deadline part is key. They did say, tell lawmakers this week that if they don't make a decision by today, not by the end of this month, but by today, then the NSA will have to start shutting down the program. Otherwise, it could be out of compliance on June 1st.
And so there's this middle step where they might vote for, let's say, a month-long extension or a two-month-long extension. And we've seen how successful those are in both the House and the Senate. I mean, it's just been sort of a mess where you're governing by pulling it out. And think about how these votes could be used in both a presidential election, but also in for vulnerable senators in the 2016 congressional elections. Because if you don't vote to extend it, you know, are you going to be called somebody who's weak on national security? Mm-hmm. And that puts Democrats in a bind.
Right. So everyone's worried about what their record is going to look like.
Yeah. And Chris Christie I think it was on CNN this morning, said something about who cares about privacy if they're in a coffin. Which I saw Mike Lee then saying that was the equivalent of political pornography to talk like that. But here he's saying this is so important that if we don't preserve it, we're all going to die. And then people on the other side saying, come on, more particularly on the Rand Paul side, saying our privacy issues are much more important to us than whatever we gain on that front.
Okay, Jeff, President Obama this week has banned the transfer of military equipment to local police forces. Why?
Everyone probably remembers the images in Ferguson, Missouri, after an unarmed black man, Michael Brown, was killed there, and that led to protests and riots where the police came out in riot gear and heavy machinery, weaponry. And the imagery was very, very stark. And, of course, this whole discussion has been advanced by other shootings across the country. And basically the president decided and the White House decided this week to say, local police departments do not need tanks. Local police departments do not need big artillery from the military, from the Pentagon, and they're banning the Pentagon and other federal agencies from sharing that with local police departments.
So it's about optics, but it's also about rebuilding trust with local residents from these police forces.
It absolutely is, and it's a reaction to that particular incident. But it's also just sort of looking specifically at what do police need? What do police need to rebuild this trust? They don't need those big weapons. They need to build better relationships
so
with their communities.
Right. Unnecessary equipment.
What wasn't clear to me about this, and maybe you guys know the answer, what happens to the police forces that already have all of this? Mm-hmm. Like, do they need to get rid of it? Do they need to auction it off, for charity? Like, how does that all wind down?
This whole thing got to be, so it was originally begun as like, we need to have well-fortified sort of SWAT teams in certain important parts of the country in case there's some extremist group or Al-Qaeda happening of some kind. And then it became that, particularly as the military fought all these wars various places, they had all this surplus material that they were giving to police departments. So I think it was the New York Times did a great piece that showed all the crazy stuff that's ended up in like outposts in Wyoming. And so like the, Laramie Police Department has a tank or whatever, all this crazy stuff that's been out there. So what it amounts to is it's banning the giving to police departments of tracked vehicles, so tanks, guns and ammunition over 50 caliber, bayonets, and grenade launchers.
Grenade launchers.
Right. Yeah, grenade launchers.
I cannot imagine Laramie, Wyoming needing a tank. What kind of action is going to take place?
It's like that, right? It's that. What it hasn't banned is, and this is a loophole that's out there, is that a lot of these police departments have also used DHS grants from the Homeland Security Department to buy some of these things. And as long as they find the money somehow, they still will be able to buy these surplus things.
So it's only banning the giving away. It's not actually banning the acquisition.
Yeah.
Christina, how are the police departments reacting to the president's order?
That I'm actually not that familiar with. But Congress is, in some ways, breathing a sigh of relief, right? Because they were sort of starting to look at this issue when Democrats were still in charge of the Senate. You saw a lot of hearings on demilitarization of police, but they have not wanted to really touch it. It is not a popular thing for them to really approach. And, you know, given what happened in Baltimore and the debate sort of got revived after the riots there. And so Congress has been like, oh, are we going to have to deal with this again? And so they said, okay, good. The president has done something. We can at least point to that. And hopefully we're not going to have to address this again.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how big of an issue it's becoming for the president in the waning days and in the last year and a half of his presidency. It's when he unveiled this earlier this week, he talked about not only these new restrictions on weaponry, but having a broader shift in how law enforcement treats its communities and works with people that it is serving. And that, I think, is going to be, particularly under Loretta Lynch as well, a really big issue.
We're going to take a short break. I look forward to hearing your questions and your comments on police tactics and equipment and lots of other issues we're talking about today. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking today with Neil King Jr., Global Economics Editor and Deputy Washington Bureau Chief of The Wall Street Journal, Christina Bellantone, Editor-in-Chief of Roll Call, Jeff Mason, White House Correspondent for Reuters. So before the break, we were talking about President Obama's decision to stop the free transfer from the federal government of military equipment to local police forces. Neil, the Fraternal Order of Police came out with a statement reacting to this. What's your sense of how the police have reacted in general?
Well, there's been a fair bit of tension between various police departments and the National Organization of Organizations of Police, basically accusing the president of having intervened and decided to use his very loud podium, basically, to critique or to weigh in on some of these things that are extremely local. And their argument is that he's been too quick to side with the victim, too easy to sort of overlook the the intense pressures that the police departments live under in these places where the crime rate is extremely high and where the tensions between the community and the police forces are very delicate. And so there's a fair bit of bad blood. And he went up to Camden, is what Jeff was referring to earlier this week, to make this announcement, which is a place where they were trying to highlight that the relations between police and community have actually improved a lot. And they were highlighting that as an example. But a lot of the police organizations use that as a moment to also say, but wait, Mr. President, you've also been a little too quick to judge us.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, I mean, this whole debate over the use of police force is happening at the same time that a grand jury in Baltimore has actually indicted six officers in the death of Freddie Gray. We have seen in the last year that grand juries elsewhere have not indicted police officers when black men who had not committed any major crime were killed by the cops. What makes this time different?
I think these stories are getting a lot more attention. It's hard to say what's different. I think some people will ask, why did my son or daughter not get the same kind of attention when the same exact thing happened a year ago or two or three? But certainly in the last months and years, they're getting a lot more attention. It's gone up to the plate of the president. And I think he would say in response to some of the criticisms from the police that, you know, every time he does make a comment or weigh in on something like this, he also mentions very specifically that most cops are terrific and understands the pressures that they face. But, you know, the evidence, the statistics, and not just the anecdotal evidence that we've seen with stories like the ones in Baltimore and elsewhere show that it's a real problem, and it's one that he takes seriously because he's the commander-in-chief, but also because he's the first black president.
And the president has very strongly condemned any violence against police in retaliation for that. I mean, you have seen this just tragic thing unfold over the last year, really, starting with Ferguson, New York, Baltimore. And so, you know, that's one of the first things he'll always say whenever he gives a statement about
it. Mm-hmm. All right, Neil, back to Capitol Hill. The Senate has cleared a hurdle for President Obama to have fast-track authority on a Pacific Rim trade deal, but we are not there yet. So why is this so controversial, and why is it so important to the president?
Well, it's hugely important to the president in a lot of ways to the country because it would be the biggest, most comprehensive trade deal the U.S. has ever done, 12 countries in all, spanning the Pacific, Japan, and most importantly, Canada, Mexico, which we already have a deal with, but a whole slew of countries, and 40% of the economy, global economy, is accounted for by these countries. And a setback, if it were not to go through, would be pretty large for just U.S. prestige overall. So the complexity on the Hill, there are so many strands of it, it's almost hard to know where to start. I mean, it's amazing that on the Democratic side, support for trade has basically collapsed. I mean, you have 185 House Democrats, if my math is right. At the moment, I think the House is expecting that they might get support from maybe 15 when this comes, push comes to shove. Last time around, when President Bush, George W. Bush, sought it in 2002, he got 27 House Democrats to support him. So that's been a big drop. And then there's just a huge amount of distrust among Republicans saying, do we really want to give this president more authority? The thing that they're actually voting on is called trade promotion authority. And they're saying, of all guys that we don't want to give more authority to do big sweeping international things that we don't understand very much, it's not Barack Obama. And there are all sorts of other things that we could unravel. But so it's expected to get through the Senate. And which it had been all along. It could be really tight. It may spill into tomorrow. Then the big thing is, will it get through
tomorrow
the
meaning
House?
Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Bingo. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, again, a short
Saturday,
weekend
right.
for the Senate.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Christina, what has the reaction been from progressive Democrats and labor groups over all of this?
They're furious. And there's a lot of people who feel the president is letting them down on this issue. They have been campaigning against it for a very long time, spending a lot of money, advocacy, you know, getting out there on Capitol Hill every day. But this is an area where the Republicans, when they were able to win control of the Senate last fall, and people started looking to an all-Republican Congress, where are areas of compromise? And this was the number one thing on the list. You've seen Paul Ryan put his neck out there on the line for this. You know, another thing where Ted Cruz and the president agree on is this mm-hmm. issue. And the Republicans, I think, are making a political balance. Do they want to give the president that they say, you know, shouldn't have any power at all, and they're suing him for other items, and they're waiting for what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act at the Supreme Court? Do they give him this authority mm-hmm. and sort of look at compromise with him, or do they, you know, say, no, we're going to say he he's not the right guy. And I think that they're politically calculating that they'd rather see the Democrats mad within their own party, particularly with the presidential race out there and Hillary Clinton under increasing pressure to have to take a side
to weaken
and
them
talk
from
about
within.
This. Mm-hmm. You know, the 2008 presidential race, and they fought about NAFTA, even though neither of them had anything to do with it in the Democratic presidential primary. You know, Hillary Clinton was very much on the sidelines and was not in favor of it when her husband, you know, pushed it through as president. So this is going to be something that continues to divide the Democrats. If it passes, they're going to continue to debate it. And as this gets uglier and uglier on Capitol Hill, I think that that small vote in the House is going to be the real problem for the Republicans.
Well, your point about Democrats and what the base thinks about this in 2016 is really relevant. We have an email from Diane in New York City who says it would be difficult to adequately state the sense of disappointment and betrayal that many of us feel concerning the president's fast-track efforts on TPP. As a former fervent supporter and twice voter, it is astounding that this so-called populist president is now in the thrall to big business and corporations. So, Jeff, that's a pretty damning indictment.
The White House absolutely rejects that criticism.
All right.
The president has taken it quite personally as well. I mean, you saw him. He gave a press conference at Camp David last week that I was at, where he was asked again about this trade agreement and asked in particular about the sort of division between him and Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is a leader of the progressives and a bit of a thorn in the side of both the administration and of the Hillary Clinton campaign. And the president just, again, described the two of them as a friend, made a point of referring to her again by her first name, which he'd been criticized for doing, and said over and over again, look, you guys, I'm one of you. I am a progressive, and what I'm suggesting is actually good for the country, good for jobs. I wouldn't sign up to it if it didn't have the protections on the environment and on labor standards that you all are worried about. But it is absolutely not something that progressives are buying, and that's hurting.
But, it, you know, those lines in that email, I mean, this person has probably gathered that from this sort of grassroots opposition, that the labor unions have been very successful in spreading that message. I've had so many people tell me, I'm so against this, I'm so mad at the president, but they don't really understand, like, the particulars in the deal. And I'm not a trade reporter. I'm not sure I could explain it for half an hour either, but they're opposed to it because they've been sort of conditioned and seeing it, especially in like their own networks, you know, on Facebook. There's a lot of opposition out there. That's where the labor unions have been successful. They're not going to be successful.
So they spread
the
message it's bad for jobs, bad for the environment, bad for conditions. Neil, what is your sense of what is ultimately going to happen on the other side of this? Does this bill have support in the House?
John Boehner is in this position where he will have to muster very large support among his Republican caucus to make up for the math where, if they're lucky, the White House, for all of the lobbying that they've been doing, and this is probably the most muscular, certainly the most muscular lobbying they've had to do during this whole time of their own members, they'll be lucky to get 20. John Boehner will have to make up the rest. My prediction is that they will, like these things tend to happen, they'll barely squeeze it out, and it'll pass by probably a vote, which is the way these things go. But it is striking. You look at a state like California, which is, of course, very Democratic, particularly along the coast. You look at even the city of San Francisco, which is a place that, if you want to pick a place that's benefited from globalization and where rents and everything else are soaring, and it's very hard to see the soft spot there. You have a representative, Nancy Pelosi, who happens to be the minority leader, who's extremely ambivalent on this, which more shows that there's this sort of ideological current among the Democratic caucus that's extremely strong, very frustrating to Barack Obama, but not in this case, really particularly representative of the base of the people who live in that place. So this would even apply to parts of Silicon Valley. I mean, if there is a place that's going to benefit from TPP, I think that would be one of them. But again, if the union strength and just the liberal unease about what this might mean is very strong.
Well, regardless of the liberal unease, it sounds like it's probably going to scrape through the Senate, then meet an uncertain fate in the House, but you think ultimately make it through by a hair?
Yeah, I think so. Boehner's talking about bringing it up in the next couple of weeks after the recess. We'll see. It'll be a fun June.
I will say it has really highlighted not just Elizabeth Warren's place nationally, but she can really influence the debate in Congress. And as I think now it's died down a little bit of, is she going to run for president? She's not going to run for president. But it does demonstrate that if she stays in Congress, she can actually be an influential voice in this debate, even in the minority party. You know, she's allowing this conversation to be shaped. And, you know, I've also said she's very popular among Democrats. Is it really terrible to have a popular figure in Congress since they're the most reviled institution institution in the country right now. So in the end, that could be good for a robust debate.
Okay. Jeff, this week we saw a huge recall of airbags made by the Japanese manufacturer Takata, and this is going to affect 34 million cars. Why is this happening?
Yeah, it's a lot. The Japanese company Takata, as you mentioned, is one of the largest suppliers of airbags in the world. And after a long time of denying any sort of problems with their product, they finally admitted that they were defective and doubled the number of vehicles for recall in the United States to 34 million. That's one in seven of more than 250 million cars on U.S.
Wow.
roads. So it's a lot. Basically, the airbags have, they're connected to six deaths, more than 100 injuries. They can explode violently when they deploy, sending shrapnel out. And Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox said that up until now, this is his direct quote, up until now, Takata has refused to acknowledge that their airbags are defective. That changes today. And it changes in a massive way that affects a lot of consumers and a lot of car companies, which are saying it could take several years for all of these airbags to be replaced and for these cars to be recalled. So it's a big deal.
So, Neil, which cars are affected and what are vehicle owners supposed to do now?
If only I knew. I don't think anybody actually really knows. It's there are 15, they think at the moment there are 15 different brands. It's very heavy on Toyota and Honda, which wouldn't be surprising. And up to 60 different models. The last I saw, they were expected to come out in coming days with something that would be an exhaustive list. But it's really complicated. This goes back 15 years or more. So there are cars from the early 2000s that would have these airbags in them. And because of it's also going to be difficult, of course, just because people buy and sell cars among themselves. But in terms of what the supply chain is for which particular models of which particular cars these bags went into is going to take some time to sort out. And it's already causing a lot of nervousness among people that are wondering if they're driving one of these cars.
I think the NHTSA has a website that people can look up and see if their car is on it.
Before walking in here, there was a story that had been out like in the last 2 hours that Mazda, Mitsubishi, and Subaru have now joined this. Toyota is one of the heaviest expected, but I was realizing, you know, I drive a Honda, like, I guess I'll get something in the mail if I need to do something here. But for me, it's interesting with what GM went through last year, right? Like, from a company perspective, like, how do you rehabilitate your image? And they still are trying to get out from underground because it's been such an ugly process for them.
And how long is it going to take to replace all these airbags?
Right. I mean, it could be another...
They're saying 5 years, yeah, something like that.
Good number. Incredible.
$2
billion. $33 million inflators needed to do this.
Yeah. I mean, and the White House even yesterday weighed in and urged people to go to that website, double check whether or not your vehicle is affected, because as we were saying when we were talking about how many are involved here, it's a lot.
Yeah, well, a lot of advocates are saying that consumers should be given rental cars or loaner cars in the interim to make up for this, because it's going to be a huge inconvenience for millions and millions of people. Neil, a huge victory this week for supporters of the minimum wage and the Fight for 15 campaign. Tell us what happened in Los Angeles.
Well, this has been percolating for a while. The city council, it's still not final. It has to go through another step, but voted overwhelmingly in favor for raising the minimum wage from $9 an hour in Los Angeles to $15 an hour by 2020. So that's a 65% increase, something like that, happening at a time when wages, particularly at the low end of the wage scale, which this would obviously apply to, are growing at like 2% a year if you're lucky. And at a time when there's been a big national minimum wage debate that's pretty much going nowhere in Congress.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or follow us on Facebook and send us a tweet. Don't forget, you can see all of our guests live right now on a video stream at drshow.org. So, you know, continuing on that minimum wage fight, Christina, it strikes me that a few years ago, a $15 minimum wage would have sounded completely preposterous, not possible to get, even from the advocates. So how did we get here? year to this point.
Well, and I mean, I think it's important to point out that it's going to take a number of years before it actually is fully in effect. And there, more than half of the Los Angeles population earns the minimum wage right now. That's a huge number. And I think, you know, personally, as a California native, I will say California has led the way on many things. And you've seen big cities taking the lead on efforts like this because people can't afford to live where they are working. And the president tried to make this a big initiative. You know, he's done some efforts, particularly with federal contractors, and in sort of a step back has said, look, like, I think private industry will end up leading the way. We've seen McDonald's, Walmart, other companies at least trying to raise it a little bit. But you've heard during the 2014 congressional elections that a lot of lawmakers were saying they support efforts at the state level to, you know, raise them or put things on the ballot. And that might be where the future is, because a federal minimum wage increase is not going to happen.
Well, Jeff, are we going to see other cities following suit?
Well, I think that's probably, I think there probably will be. And other cities have already done this, like Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle. And I think it's interesting to look at the politics of it. The president has made raising the minimum wage a key issue the last few years. And I think critics and jaded reporters have thought, you know, why is he doing this? This isn't going to happen. You're definitely not going to get a federal minimum wage passed. But what is happening is the cities and specific companies, Walmart, Facebook, others are taking moves because of taking it up locally and taking it up themselves because of the pressure, as Christina mentioned, for there to be a living wage.
And LA could be a tipping point given the size of the city, maybe New York City in the not too distant future.
For sure.
I was going to think it's in Washington is thought to come up next. But what's interesting is this actually kind of goes to this conservative argument in a way, which is let's not do it federal. Let's let the localities live by their own economic logic and have the wages reflect what the dynamic of that marketplace is. So this may not be what they like, but it definitely reflects that sort of philosophy.
We're going to take a short break now. And when we're back, we're going to go to your calls and your questions. Stay tuned to The Diane Rehm Show.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at gotomeeting.com.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, ISIS takes control of the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. Southeast Asian nations agree to temporarily shelter a new wave of migrants on the high seas. And the U.S. and Cuba move one step closer to full diplomatic ties. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Today, we're talking with Jeff Mason, White House correspondent for Reuters, Christina Bellantoni, editor-in-chief of Roll Call, and Neil King, Jr., global economics editor at The Wall Street Journal. Neil, we have got to go now to one of the really most interesting stories of the week, I think, that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. Four giant global banks agreed to pay $5 billion in fines to the U.S. government. Which banks, and why are they paying out?
It's actually really rather extraordinary. Where if you just look at the U.S. side of this equation, you have J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup, the first and third largest banks in the country, having agreed to felonies, basically. So two of the biggest, three biggest banks in the country, now essentially convicted felons, large, very, very large fines. J.P. Morgan Chase over is about $1.3 billion in fines. The allegations against four of the banks, I think there were five altogether, weren't there? Yeah, it was four banks that were involved in allegations of that they manipulated currency rates,
and then there was also UBS.
And then UBS
was
also...
which pled guilty, and so therefore they got off.
Right.
They
didn't have to pay. The UBS, which has been slapped for a whole bunch of other things over the last couple of years, was involved in the accusation there was that they had manipulated the LIBOR rate, which is the rate for interbank loans, and it's usually a minuscule thing. All of this stuff, because there's the money that moves is so vast, if you can fix just tiny fractions of a percent to your advantage when you're doing euro to dollar exchanges or whatever, you can make a lot of money doing that. And the allegations for the other four banks, Royal Bank of Scotland, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Barclays, was that these traders had basically set up a sort of chat room, which they called, oddly enough, the cartel. And for years, they were texting one another in this sort of chat room that would they would come to agreements that they would either intervene in ways that would shift the exchange rate in ways that was predictable that they could make money off of, or they would assure some period of calm where somebody could then complete some sort of deal that would be profitable to them. The thing that shocked a lot of people is not just the size of these crimes, not the size of the crime, the size of the fines, but how little reaction there's been in the market. The stock prices didn't go down at all for any of these things. And the fact that no individual was charged.
Right.
So you have people like Elizabeth Warren and others saying, wait, so these banks committed felonies, but there are no felons?
And the market didn't even react, as you said. I mean, Christina, essentially we're talking about a crime of conspiring to fix rates and completely manipulate the market. And the sheer scale of this kind of price fixing is really hard to comprehend. And yet it is so rare for a big financial institution to be found guilty of criminal behavior. Why do you think it happened this time?
I mean, I think part of it was it seemed like they were cooperating with, you know, admitting wrongdoing. But one thing, this is a $3.4 trillion market, right, between all of the different currencies across the globe. Globalization has made this an even larger issue, you know, over the last 50, 60 years. And I didn't quite understand it. My husband's Australian, and he had a business in the UK where he was living. And now I get it, right? Like, if he tries to transfer money here to the U.S. so, you know, we can pay off our second mortgage on our house, he has to do it at a certain time of day because that's when the rates are fixed. So, like, this actually, like, I can completely understand why even the slightest percentage makes a huge difference for a lot of people.
And yet the last U.S. bank that I can think of convicted of a comparable felony was Drexel Burnham Lambert in the late 80s, right, Neil? I mean, that many people don't even remember about that bank, and yet we've seen so much going on in Wall Street since with, you know, the mortgage issue, and yet this is the first thing that happens. I wonder whether some of that is blowback from people not being punished, banks not being punished for what happened in 2008.
Well, there have been a series of various penalties. This one stands out because of the basically copping to a felony charge. But over the past 2 years, it's been about $60 billion in penalties that have come onto the various banks from a whole variety of sources, not just the Justice Department, the Federal Reserve. There have been attorney general in various states that have gone after the banks for different practices. This is, I guess, as much as anything, an example that if you're close to the money, it's easy to make money by siphoning ever tiny fractions off that money. And the, you know, the criminal possibilities are obviously large. And the fact that they stumbled in a way upon this, you know, obscure chat room where this all was going on was pretty remarkable. It also would give you the indication that there's probably a need
there's
for more vigilance.
There's a lot more going on, probably, that we don't know about. You can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org. And if you want to call us, it's 800-433-8850. You can also send us a message, an email, a tweet. You can get us on Facebook. So, Jeff, The State Department is expected to release emails written by Hillary Clinton during her time as Secretary of State. When are we going to see this first batch?
Yeah, that's a good question. Probably soon. A judge ruled that the State Department needs to roll out these 55,000 pages of emails over a consistent period, as opposed, I guess the State Department had said it might take them until January to get them all ready. And this judge said he wants them to be released on a gradual basis. And the secretary, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, spoke unusually to reporters this week and repeated again that she wants them out as soon as possible. So there's a lot of pressure on the State Department, both from the now presidential candidate Hillary Clinton as well as from the courts to get these things out.
Well, she wants them out, and somehow the New York Times managed to get a third of this first batch of emails in advance. So, Christina, did they find any smoking gun or any new evidence about Benghazi?
This is my exciting bookmarked weekend reading, actually, because I have not gone through them yet. But if you're going to release emails, probably the Friday of Memorial Day weekend is a pretty good time to do it. Mm-hmm. Nobody's paying attention.
That's called a Friday news dump.
Look, the House Republicans, particularly the ones that believe that there is a smoking gun on the Benghazi attacks of 2011, are going to go through these word by word by word. And no doubt there will be something that they can use in a campaign against her. But this is someone who has been in public life and has been subjected to having little privacy as a government, whether that's official or outside of the official stature, for a very long time. Like, the chances that they're going to find something really extraordinary, I'd wager, are pretty low. But that doesn't mean they're not going to parse every single word.
And keep in mind as well that Hillary Clinton and or her people have perused every single one of these emails. Mm-hmm. It was the former Secretary of State who decided which emails to turn over
to the State Department in the first place.
Right. Yeah. So, and she, as we just said, is actively asking for these things to be released. They know exactly what's in there.
Mm-hmm. So unlikely to be any surprises. Neil, it means we could be seeing this first batch very soon, maybe even today, some people have suggested. When will the rest of all these emails be made public?
Well, there was talk that it might be as late as early 2016 before we would see all of them. It sounds as if
a federal judge rejected that plan, right?
Right. I mean, I think we're just going to see a year where various of these things are dribbling out or pouring out in various batches. I mean, the thing that's so striking about all this is you have a woman who launched a presidential campaign just recently. She's been now trying to run a political campaign for president, which is campaigns are about now and about the future. Everything that she's had to deal with is about the past. And it's going to be the biggest burden for her. I mean, she's had to talk about, or, you know, there was all the revelation about, wasn't revelation, they just disclosed how much money they had made in all their past speeches, her and her husband, $25 million over the last 16 months or whatever it's been. The whole thing of Sidney Blumenthal, who's a past aide to her that was rejected essentially as somebody that she might have brought into the State Department, but that the White House didn't want. He had been advising her sort of surreptitiously through emails about Benghazi and other things. All of the emails, which were going to be, so it's all this baggage that she's going to be carrying that's all about things that she did months ago, years ago, and
but it was always going to be that way for Hillary Clinton to run president. It was always going
to
happen.
She's likely to testify, too, before the special committee on Benghazi, before the House in July. And that's
perhaps the only presidential candidate who's going to be testifying.
Right. She has already spoken to this many times, on Capitol Hill, but this will be the kind of the big show. And don't forget, they delayed this committee's work in part to push it as close to the 2016 election
for an October surprise or something.
Interesting, though, about that testimony, that Democrats are actually not worried about Hillary Clinton's potential performance. In fact, polling shows that they're more excited that Republicans may overplay their hand in that type of a hearing, which could, in the end, be helpful to her.
She's quite experienced on these kinds of
matters. Yes, she is. And, Jeff, you said that she was talking to the national press in Iowa for the first time in about a month.
First time
in a controversy
in about a month.
Foundation.
I think she took about half a dozen questions. She addressed issues which Neil sort of referred to as well about her foundation. She said she's the Bill Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. She said she's proud of it. She let the American people decide about some of the funding controversies. She was asked about Iraq and repeated her line that she said for some time now that her vote to approve the invasion of Iraq was a mistake, plain and simple. About the income that Neil was referring to that they've made, she said, Bill and I have been blessed, but we haven't forgotten where we've come from. She addressed the Sidney Blumenthal issue and said, you know, I have a lot of friends and I'm going to continue to take advice from my friends.
With a loud belly laugh.
Right, which is her signature.
Yeah.
Indeed. And then on the email issue, which we've already discussed, she repeated again that she wants them out as soon as possible.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have a call from Philip in Ocala, Florida. Philip, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, I just woke up after holding.
Well, we're waiting for you here. Please proceed.
On your first subject, the NSA, I am amazed at the naivety of the Congress and the news media. I had a top secret clearance when I was in the service, which was the early 70s, before social media and all that stuff. And even if the NSA gets voted down, why do you think the CIA internationally, the FBI domestically, the OSI, NCIS, ICE, and all these other people who have been monitoring phone calls either will stop?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is national security. I was in the service during, quote, the Cold War, a different time, a different place, but it was just as important.
All right. So we have Philip saying... We have Philip saying that basically you're naive if you think that the Patriot Act debate makes any difference because the NSA is going to go right on ahead doing whatever it wants to.
Or there will be some way around it, right? An emergency order or some other agency that's collecting it. I think Americans, especially when you look at polling, there's now a basic assumption that your information is being tabulated, collected, read, eavesdropped on, right? It's become almost a pop culture joke to have this understanding now. And that's such a shift over the last 15 years. And I think people are fed up with it, but it's also something they can really understand, right? People know if they are sending emails and if somebody is reading those emails or collecting them based on whatever dealings they're having with anybody, that makes people uncomfortable in a lot of cases.
But that shift has also, of course, come about during a time, 15 years or so, where people have decided to disclose everything about themselves in real time, all the time, on Facebook, Twitter, everything else. I mean, the degree of transparency to which people are now willing to live and is so high that I think people have kind of they've shifted their presumption of privacy or their how much they assume that they're going to be having anyway. But I was a little unclear as to whether he was getting to that we should assume that we're being spied on, or whether there's a continued need to be doing it. I mean, the difficulty, of course, since the Cold War is that we now have this sort of threat of people within the United States that might even have U.S. citizenship, but have, aims or motives that are, you know, somehow scary. The whole kind of like people returning from possible service in Syria that might have some aims. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a lot of the stuff that they're now trying to go after.
And with the internet being a huge part of the recruiting tool for groups like ISIS.
Well, and that's part of the political debate as well. You've got some people pressing for privacy, but others saying, look, this is a time when ISIS is really a threat in the Middle East and potentially a threat to the United States. This shouldn't be a time when we're letting down our guard in terms of some of our biggest tools.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Neil, we got an email here from Peggy, who is saying, I think your panelists are wrong when they say progressives oppose the trade pact with the Pacific because they don't understand it. I think that progressives are opposed because they witnessed what happened to our country under NAFTA. And this is Peggy from New Hampshire. Can you take that?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating that Peggy would mention NAFTA because NAFTA has been so much the focus. But again, and I wouldn't be accusing people of not understanding it. It's extremely complicated dynamic to understand, because basically NAFTA came about in 1993, which also happens to be, and it was the first time the U.S. had done a trade deal with a markedly less, you know, well-off country with a substantially lower wage base. So people look at NAFTA as being the force that sort of gutted U.S. manufacturing. What they don't really note is that, yes, our exports to Mexico, U.S. imports from Mexico have skyrocketed since then, but our exports to Mexico have gone up significantly in the meantime. Our overall trade relationship with Mexico has increased markedly. What people don't really notice or note all that much is that the most significant factor was not a trade agreement, but the fact that China entered the WTO in the late 90s, early 2000. We granted them what we call PNTR, most favored nation status, which was sort of a given that that would happen. That's been much more the imbalancing factor. We're talking about huge globalization forces way more than we're talking about the impact of actual particular trade deals.
Okay. Jeff, we would be remiss if we did not bring up Fox News,
yes,
who is going to host the first GOP presidential primary debate, and they say only 10 of the many, many candidates we know of already will be allowed to participate. So who's going to make the cut?
Well,
and how much does that even matter?
It might be easier to say who won't make the cut. Mm-hmm. The criteria that Fox has set is that the candidates who appear on stage will need to be in the top 10 of the average of the five most recent polls. So that could leave out, there's about 18 candidates or potential candidates right now for the Republican field. That would probably leave out, at least according to polling now, people like Senator Lindsey Graham, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, Senator Rick Santorum, and former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina. And those candidates will obviously object to criteria like that because it is exactly those debates that give them a chance to raise their profile when perhaps they've had a hard time. But the Republicans, on the other hand, you don't want to see 18 people on the stage.
It's hard to get a substantive debate with that many people. I will point out two things. Rick Santorum, the second-place finisher in the last presidential primary, and you know, having him shut off stage, I think, does a disservice to people. And then the other thing is Carly Fiorina, for example, has said, I will meet that challenge. Well, how do you meet that challenge? You know how? With spending money, right? Mm-hmm. If she spends enough money on ads, she might be able to get her profile raised just enough. And then that's inserting even more money into the system, which generally people say they don't like having it so much in the system.
Christina, we have just 30 seconds on this, but earlier this week, Jeb Bush said those who have a problem with his name need to get over it. Tell us about that.
the dynasty question is amusing. And I think that if it's Bush versus Clinton, again, you're going to hear a lot of complaining in the media about this. American voters don't seem to have as much of a problem as people that are within like the political professional class.
Christina Bellantoni, editor-in-chief of Roll Call. Neil King Jr., global economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. Excuse me. And Jeff Mason, White House correspondent of Reuters. And I'm Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening.
Thanks, Indira.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Urblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C.